Welcome to today's Journal Club webinar. My name is Rachel Dager. I'm the Executive Director of SNEB and glad you're joining us today. Just a little housekeeping to get us started. If you look in the GoToWebinar tool panel, you'll see the slides for today's presentation. So please download those and follow along. We will take questions at the end of the presentation, so type those in the question block so we can moderate those to our presenters. And when I close the webinar today, there's a short survey. So we appreciate your feedback on this session, as well as ideas for future webinars. Then watch for an email later this week that includes the link to the recording, the slides, as well as the CEU certificate that you're earning for your attendance. So I want to introduce our moderator today. Dr. Kristen DiFilippo is teaching assistant professor at the University of Illinois.
Thanks, Rachel, and thank you to our presenters for being here today. We have Dr. Rhea. She is a program analyst in the Division of Healthcare Quality Promotion at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in Atlanta, Georgia. She recently earned her doctorate in nutrition and food sciences from Louisiana State University and developed interests in public health and program evaluation. Dr. Cater is an associate professor in the Department of Agriculture and Extension Education and Evaluation and regional director with the LSU Ag Center. She has extensive experience in instrument development, outcome measurement, and program evaluation. Dr. Cater is actively engaged in teaching young professionals the craft of evaluation and has taught graduate level courses in program development, program evaluation, survey design, data analysis and interpretation, and data collection methods with children and youth. Her research interests include evaluation of non-formal educational programs, assessing program quality and implementation of programs, and survey design for diverse audiences. Today, they are going to be talking with us about the research behind questionnaire development research methods. And again, I want to thank them both for being here and sharing their expertise with us. At this point, I can pass it over to our presenters.
Okay, so good morning or good afternoon, depending on where you're located. Dr. Cater and I are very excited to present to you all our research methods for the Eating and Food Literacy Behaviors Questionnaire. This work was a part of my dissertation while at Louisiana State University. And so before we get started, I just wanted to disclose that there are no funding or conflicts of interest. And as far as nutrition educator competencies, this particular webinar will address 7-1, 8-1, and 10-1. So this work was from a paper published, a psychometric analysis of the Eating and Food Literacy Behaviors Questionnaire with university students. The primary objective of this study was to, one, develop a questionnaire capable of measuring young adults' perceived food literacy behaviors, and then also to validate that particular questionnaire. So for the purpose of this presentation, we will explore the research methods for the instrument development, as well as dive into the exploratory factor analyses, test-retest reliability, confirmatory factor analyses, and other methods used in order to establish validity for the questionnaire. So just a little bit of background. Food literacy was initially and widely defined by Weigman and Galagos in 2014. And so the definition of food literacy is really this collection of interrelated knowledge, skills, and behaviors that are required to plan, manage, select, prepare, and eat food that meet needs and determine individual intake. For the purpose of our questionnaire, we were more so interested in the behavior aspect of food literacy. Upon a survey of the literature, we found that higher levels of food literacy were associated with positive dietary behaviors, such as increased frequency and consumption of fruits, vegetables, and fish. Individuals with higher levels of food literacy also exhibited greater self-control and less impulsiveness when eating. And so all in all, this concept of food literacy was related to improved diet quality, health, and well-being. which is a possible way to address complex public health issues such as obesity. So we were very much so interested in exploring dietary behaviors from a food literacy lens. What we found at the time of this study was that many of the food literacy measurement tools that were available were based on the initial definition that I shared from authors Feigen and Galagos. Very few of the food literacy instruments known at the time actually considered dietary behaviors, and so there was a need in order to identify what behaviors are relevant in the context of food literacy. At the time of the study, there were only 12 known food literacy instruments that had been validated within an adult population, and these populations were primarily international. There were some studies done in Italy as well as Australia, and what was known about food literacy is that it's a highly contextual idea. And so the first part of our study was to develop an instrument that was capable of measuring food literacy in a young adult population. And so this diagram here just gives us a good sense of how we approached instrument development. The first thing was conducting a literature review, which supports the Feigen and Galagos study. We also were interested in collecting data from our study population to inform food literacy in their context. As I mentioned before, food literacy is highly contextual, so it was very important for us to identify this in the specific population. We also sought to define our constructs, which again was heavily related to Feigen and Galagos' framework, which I will share a little later. We also generated items, and then from there made sure to include appropriate response scales and demographics when developing our questionnaire. We reviewed the content and administered the questionnaire in order to analyze it and come down to our best version of the EFLBQ. So the items generated for our questionnaire were primarily based on Feigen and Galagos' conceptual framework of food literacy, which has four domains, as you can see here in the figure to my left. The first was planning and managing food, and this included things like prioritizing money and time for food or making feasible food decisions. The second domain was selecting food, so anything from being able to judge the quality of food or accessing food through multiple sources. Food literacy also included the domain of preparation, so being able to apply basic principles of safe food hygiene and handling, and also making good tasting meals from whatever food is available. The last concept in this framework was the idea of eating, and that includes anything from joining in to eat in a social way or understanding that food has an impact on personal well-being. So again, to supplement this information that was found in our literature search, we conducted semi-structured interviews with our study population, and from there combined these data to develop behavioral items for our questionnaire. The items were reviewed and approved by a nutrition educator and a program evaluation specialist. So the participants for our study, as mentioned before, were young adults. We primarily looked at individuals who were between the ages of 18 and 30 years old. For the purposes of our institutional review board approval, we excluded individuals who were pregnant and non-US citizens. Our sample for this study was a convenient sample of university students, and so there were various colleges and majors represented, and overall this study was approved by the LSU Ag Center Institutional Review Board. So this development of the questionnaire at hand was not at all a one-hit wonder. We went through very different versions of the questionnaire before we arose to the final version. And so I just kind of wanted to walk you all through our process for doing so. So as I mentioned before, we generated items based on our literature review as well as the semi-structured interviews that were conducted with the study population. From that data, we identified 28 behavioral items in the first version of the EFLBQ, and this version included 8 demographic questions, which include age, gender, race and ethnicity, self-perceived height and weight, and also three questions about living arrangements. Our initial response scale for the first version of the questionnaire was a 5-point Likert type scale, and the options were never, seldom, always, and often, in which our respondents were able to identify how they resonated with each behavioral item. As far as proposed factors, prior to identifying the items, we wanted to keep the initial version as closely related to the framework that was previously shared. So we tried to make sure that our items fit within these same parameters, which included planning and managing, selecting, preparing, and eating foods. And so of those different domains, there were 7 items from each domain that ultimately contributed to the total 28 behavioral items. So following development of the first version of the EFLBQ, we put our questionnaire through an exploratory factor analysis in order to identify how the questionnaire would factor. And so Dr. Cater will share a little bit more about those specific processes, but after we conducted our first exploratory factor analysis on the first version of the questionnaire, only 12 of the 28 behavioral items that we included were retained. And so there were a few shortcomings to our first version of the questionnaire. And so from there, we really tried in our second version to address some of those shortcomings. And so you'll notice that as we move from version 1 to version 2, that there were slightly fewer behavioral items. We also removed some of the demographic questions related to living arrangements. And the reason being is because that information we identified as being nice to know, but not necessarily need to know. We also remove the response option of does not apply, because we did want to allow the participants to respond to each of the questions. We also noticed from our interpretation that the factors we initially identified based on Bogdan and Galagos's framework did not factor as expected. And so in the second version of this questionnaire, we started to see more of our items factor around the idea of choosing foods, purchasing foods, preparing foods, and consuming foods. So most of these factors had 7 items each. And for the latter, which is consuming foods, there were only 6 items. So in total, 21 of the items from the second version of the questionnaire were retained after doing an exploratory factor analysis. So moving on to the third version of the questionnaire, we did add a few more questions because we noticed some differences in how our respondents were identifying eating. At some point, they would see eating as an idea that before eating and after eating. So we really wanted to see if we can tease that out. And so that's where the basis of our third questionnaire came in. We kept the same Likert type scale using that 4-point response option with the options for our respondents being never, always, sometimes, and often. And for the third version, we identified 6 different factors that we thought that the questionnaire would factor into. And those were health and nutrition, food preparation, planning and decision making, conscious eating, convenience, and taste. And so from the second version to the third version of this questionnaire, we started to notice that health and nutrition was a very interesting factor for our participants and really had touched in all of the different areas. And so from that third version, following an exploratory factor analysis, we retained a total of 19 items. And so our final version of the eating and food literacy behaviors questionnaire included 19 behavior items based on a 4-point Likert type scale. There were five demographic questions that were asked: age, gender, race and ethnicity, self-reported height and weight. And these, the latter of the two, were used to calculate body mass index. And there were five total factors that were retained in this model. And that was health and nutrition, food preparation, planning and decision making, convenience and taste. So all this to say that these were the five factors that our sample identified as being relevant to eating and food literacy behaviors. And so here we'll see an example. This is the paper version of the eating and food literacy behaviors questionnaire. And so this just gives us a sense of some of the questions in the setup of the questionnaire. So for instance, the questionnaire asks things like, I decide what I want to eat before a meal. I follow recipes when preparing food. I read nutrition information before purchasing food. And as you can see here at the end of the questionnaire, this is where we ask the different demographic questions. And also I wanted to reiterate that although this is the paper version of the EFLBQ, most of our surveys were administered online using Qualtrics software. Okay, and so for the second part of our study, we looked at validating this instrument. And so the first thing we were interested in doing was establishing construct validity using two different procedures, one being the exploratory factor analyses and the other being the confirmatory factor analyses. We also were interested in evaluating internal consistency using a Cronbach alpha method. And then lastly, determining reliability using the test-retest procedure. So at this time, I will shift gears to Dr. Cater and allow her to share her expertise and discuss more about the different methods that we use to validate the EFLBQ.
Thank you. So I'll also, I guess, give a little bit of background around some of this too as we go along, just so that you can think about how you might use it in your work, because I think it would be interesting and helpful to you to know some of this information. So we started with exploratory factor analysis, and this is the statistical procedure you use when you have a new questionnaire that's been developed and no one's ever looked at it to see if items will even correlate together to form constructs. And so that's what it means when it says it's going to reduce the data to a smaller set of summary variables. That just means that we're going to reduce items into their constructs, looking at how they all kind of relate together. In general, we look at the number of factors that we end up with. We'll produce factor loadings for each item, and we use oblique rotation to look at that simple structure. One of the things to note is when you're doing exploratory factor analysis, you need a rather large sample size. And so when you think about what size sample do I need, one good rule of thumb to use is to collect 10 responses for every item that you have on the survey. So for instance, if you have a survey that's got 28 items, you need 280 responses to be able to do that exploratory factor analysis. Now understand, that's a bare minimum, and if you get more, that's better. So you'll generate through exploratory factor analysis some descriptive statistics that'll give you some means for the items and some other information that you'll maybe want to hold on to use later when you're reporting item statistics. But in general, we're looking for some very specific information when we review the results from that EFA. Kaiser-Meyer-Olkin measure of sampling adequacy is one of those tests that we look at to understand item correlation. So we want to know that our items are correlated well enough that EFA is even warranted. Because if you don't have items that are well enough correlated, you're not going to actually come out with any really good constructs in the end. So that test will generate some kind of a number let's say 0.0 or 0.1 through 0.9 or so. The higher that number is, it's actually going to fall between 0 and 1. But the higher the number is, the better it is in terms of item correlation quality. When Kaiser first started working on this measure of sampling adequacy, he had some different categories, all of them starting at 0.5, that said this is what's a good measure of item correlation. So that tells you right off the bat, if your response on that, if your outcome is anything less than 0.5, your KMO statistics not high enough to continue with your EFA. You should stop right there. You'll typically see these numbers, fall somewhere in the 0.7 to 0.9 range. I don't know that I've ever seen one fall below 0.5. So just, you know, in general, you're going to see them come in relatively high. Hare is the one who came back and gave a little bit more guideline around this. He said 0.5 or greater was okay, but really what you're looking for is a KMO statistic that is higher than 0.7. So just put that kind of in the back of your mind that you're looking for a KMO statistic of 0.7 or higher. Bartlett's test is actually looking to see if you have an identity matrix. If you had an identity matrix, that would mean that each item stood alone. Well, you can't have a construct if each item stands alone, right? You need a set of items that work together. So Bartlett's test is looking to see, are we going to be able to generate a set of items that cluster together? And so you are looking for this test to be significant. So as long as your p-value is 0.05, a typical something in the 0.05 or less range is what you're looking for. Sometimes you will see that it's at 0.05, but I would say most of the time it would be a greater degree of significance that you'd see something in the 0.01 or even the 0.001 range is what I see often. Moving on through the results, we look at eigenvalues, and so you'll have a matrix that is generated that tells you how many constructs you have. And so you're looking for that matrix to have 1 point or higher. So 1.0 or higher there, and you can also look at your scree plot, which looks like a graph, and the point of inflection, which is where it moves from that dot and then it's got kind of a real sharp angle up, is what you're looking for there. You're looking to have at least 3 items that load onto each construct, because you don't have much of construct if you have 2 items, and you don't have a construct at all with just 1 item. So those are some of the criteria we use to determine if the items should remain in the survey. So I think Dr. Rie said earlier that we had 6 constructs at the end in that version 3, but yet she talked about the final 5. Well, that 6th construct only had 2 items, so it got dropped out. It's why it went from 6 in version 3 to 5 in the final what we used. So we determine which individual items are retained by looking at the pattern and structure matrix loadings. I will always start with that pattern matrix loading. You're looking for loadings that are 0.4 or higher, because anything less than 0.4 tells you that you don't have a whole lot of correlation among the items, either the item's contribution to the construct or its overall contribution is just not high enough. So looking for item correlations of 0.4 or higher. The other thing you're looking for is items that do not cross-load. So a cross-loading would be if 2 items wanted to, I call it play, if it wants to play on 2 constructs. So Let's say it's got 0.4 on one construct and 0.3 on the other. It can't make up its mind. It's saying, I'm confused. Do I really want to talk about taste or do I want to talk about convenience? We don't want an item that does that. So we're going to throw out items that are confused about where they belong on the construct. And then with us, we did all of our analyses in SPSS. There are other programs out there that you can use. That's just what we were using for this particular analysis. We also looked at Cronbach alpha as a measure of internal consistency reliability for the questionnaire. We were looking to make sure that each construct had a coefficient that was 0.6 or higher, and that actually, when we're looking at this, while we want it to be 0.6 or higher, the higher the Cronbach alpha is, the better. So something in the range of 0.7, 0.8, or 0.9 would be even better. Once we finished with the exploratory factor analysis, we had an idea of, okay, here are our constructs. We have a model that we'd like to test. And so going into confirmatory factor analysis, that's essentially what we're doing. At this point, we're saying we predict that these items will load on these constructs. So we have to go out and recruit a whole new sample. You can't reuse the same set of responses you had from the EFA because obviously you're just going to get the same results, right? So for confirmatory, you need to go out and get a new set of responses. So all new people, if they were in the first group, you can't use them as part of your second group for CFA. So this tests that a priori model, and we have that predetermined factor structure that came from EFA. And as Dr. Rie told you earlier, our predetermined model had 5 factors in it. And as a general rule for CFA, I look for at least 250 responses. Anything less than that, and it's going to be a little more difficult to get a good fitting model. And again, the more responses you get for this, the better off you are. So we looked at model fit statistics. In particular, we started out with RMSEA, the root mean square error of approximation. This is what we call an overall fit, an absolute fit statistic. And we are looking for values of 0.08 or less to tell us that, you know, in terms of absolute fit of our model, it looks like if it's 0.08 or less, that this is a good fitting model. But we don't use that as our only statistic for determining that. We also use the standard root mean residual, and we'll go for values that are less than 0.05 on that statistic. So both of those are absolute fit. And again, just kind of, if you want to think of it in terms of analogies, it's like an umbrella look at it. So then we want to change from that to what we call comparative fit. So it's comparing it against alternative model kind of idea. Confirmatory factor index or CFI and Tucker-Lewis index are two different indices that are generated as part of your analysis. In this particular case, we're looking for those numbers to be 0.95 or higher. So if you can get values within those ranges, then you're getting very, very good fit of your model. We used M+ for this analysis. And again, there are other programs out there like SAS that will do the same kind of analysis. This just was the one that we had available to us. And it's going to, whichever one you use, it's going to generate the same kind of information for you to use in making your determination about model fit. Now, what happens if the model doesn't fit? At that point in time, you're saying, well, you know, there was maybe an item here or there that did not fit as well into the confirmatory model as it did in the exploratory model. In the case of this instrument, it was a good fitting model from the beginning. So we didn't have to look at any of that, well, what if scenario. So once we finished with that and we said, okay, we've tested this in two large populations in terms of exploratory and confirmatory analysis, it's time to look at test retest. So test retest is looking at stability over time. And so one of the things you have to remember is some attitudes or behaviors will remain stable over time and some will not. So if you have something that you know changes over time, test retest is not a good test of reliability for you to use because the change is going to show up in your results, right? And you're going to be looking at it and saying, this is problematic. And it's not. It's just that you knew this attitude would change over time and you should have chosen a different, maybe just use your Cronbach alpha or a point estimate of reliability. In this case, we were looking to see if these would remain stable over time, particularly over a two-week time period is what we looked at. In terms of how far apart these can be, you can go anywhere from 2 weeks to 6 weeks. But if you get too much further apart than that, then you can expect that something's going to happen in a person's life and things will change, and that will affect your statistical analysis. So looking at those two time points, we're looking to have a correlation between them, and you don't really need as large of a sample size for this. So a smaller sample can be used for test retest. We've used anything from 20 to 50 people as part of that analysis. So Pearson's R is our correlation coefficient that we generated. We expect that it will be greater than 0.6, showing, you know, good test retest reliability. And it's like any correlation coefficient. The larger the coefficient, the more related the two are. You know, occasionally you'll come up when you do test retest and you may have a correlation coefficient that's 0.2. We had this happen to us one time. We're going, what's the problem here? Remember when I said earlier that it needs to be something that stays stable over time? Well, that's what happens if your behavior or your attitude changes from one time point to the next. Correlation coefficient's going to go down. So don't be stressed by that. Just understand it's explainable as a change in behavior or change in attitude. Now you just need to figure out, did I intend for, did I know that that would happen? And we used SPSS for this analysis also. So as we come to the end of it, there was quite a bit of, testing that went into the validation of this survey. And I mean, when you look at, I guess, that path that it took to get to version 3, you're all probably going, boy, that was a long path, and it was. But when we got to version 3, it was like Dr. Rie had gotten to the golden egg in terms of surveys, because everything worked so beautifully at that point in terms of research methods. And I guess I say that to tell you, don't be discouraged. If it doesn't work out with version 1, don't be discouraged. If it doesn't work out with version 2, don't be discouraged, because it will work out. It just takes, sometimes you have to drop back, rethink what's your philosophy about this instrument you're trying to develop, and keep trying. Dr. Rie is, I think, the example to me of someone who just stuck with it, because I know a lot of students who would have been so discouraged at version 1 and then just would have given up when version 2 didn't work. And she didn't do that. She kept going. And the result is a really, really solid instrument that's out there now for everyone to use. So again, don't get discouraged if it doesn't work the first or even the second time. It's just your I guess, your theoretical and your practical challenge as a researcher to figure out how to make it work. So I think we're at that question and answer point now. Dr. Rie, I'll hand it back over to you.
Sure, and thank you for that, Dr. Cater. Before we get into the questions, I did just want to acknowledge the others on our team who were very instrumental in this work. Dr. Kevin McCarter and Dr. Georgia Anatori, who are both affiliated with the LSU College of Agriculture. So at this time, Kristen, we'd be happy to entertain any questions from the audience.
Yeah, so as you have questions, if you want to put them into the question box, the first question is, did you test asking the demographic questions at the beginning of the questionnaire versus the end? And did you find that participants did not answer these? And this person says they're curious why you decided to put them at the end.
So I'll go ahead.
Okay.
So we decided to put the questions at the end of the questionnaire because we really wanted our respondents to focus in on the questions and not necessarily like the demographic information that we were interested in. I can go back to it, but if you look at the paper version of our questionnaire, you'll see here at the top, we also included a definition from the dietary guidelines, just explaining what was meant by the word healthy foods. And so again, we just wanted to get those questions right out in the open and allow them to respond to that with that information fresh on their mind.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. How many participants did you deliver the questionnaire to test comprehension, and how long did it take from start to finish to complete this questionnaire?
So as you can see, when we went through the different versions of the questionnaire, at each point we did an exploratory factor analysis. And so with that, there were about 200 respondents that responded to that. But we also had a smaller group of individuals, including Dr. Cater and another nutrition educator, that went through with reviewing some of the questions for understanding with students that were at the college. So I think one of the important things about this survey and the way that it was developed, although it took, you know, a lot of different versions to get there, we always tried to keep the study population engaged and make sure that we were addressing their needs as well and their understanding of the concept. And so I think that it was something that really helped us to identify a survey that was inclusive of the ideas of the specific target population.
Yeah.
Dr. Rie, didn't you have some of the students in one of the classes that you were teaching? Didn't you have them also review it for readability?
Yes. So we also had, like Dr. Cater mentioned, we also had some students in a nutrition class to review some of this information as well. So it was very helpful to just get their insight on clarity for questions, making sure that the items made sense and things of that sort as well.
So another question is, if you try to use this instrument, if you try to use this instrument with a different audience, how much of this work is needed to consider it valid for a new sample?
So I would recommend if you do it with a different audience, let's say you're not using college students. We're actually engaged in some of this work now with some SNAP-Ed participants. And what we're going to do is hand the questionnaire out just as it is. And then we will repeat the confirmatory factor analysis to determine, because it's not a new instrument anymore, right? We just need to confirm that these hypothesized constructs hold in this new audience. And so let's say you had a totally different, I get so caught up in what we do here. I know. Let's say you're doing an elderly audience, and so no one close to the 18 to 30 year old range that this was initially used with. Again, confirmatory factor analysis would be used to determine if these constructs hold in that audience.
And then another participant says, thank you for a great presentation. Have you translated this questionnaire to other languages? And if so, have you done any reliability or validity testing on the translated versions?
So to my knowledge, there have not been any translations of this particular questionnaire. There is currently some work being done in other areas, but that is something that we would consider for future use.
Okay. And then since food literacy has broad implications and there's a growing emphasis on systems-oriented research, do you think that the practice of excluding questions that have high loadings on multiple constructs may unintentionally result in not asking very relevant questions? And do you have suggestions for how to include important questions that may be foundational to more than one survey construct?
So you do not want an item to load on two constructs, because then what you end up with are constructs that are, I mean, you're ending up with two things that are, instead of being different, they're essentially the same, right? So if you've got thoughts or things that need to be included, try rewording, because a lot of times if you'll reword an item, you can get it to load on a single construct. So you'll get that information you're after, and you'll also get it loaded on a single construct.
And then another question is, do you have concerns regarding desirability bias, particularly given the nature of the questions in the targeted age group?
A good point. At the time, we just tried to make sure that the questions were as clear as possible, and that's where some of that work that we did with just having the study population to just take a look at it and see if these items were in fact, you know, relevant to them and meaningful. Again, that's a great question, but I think that you know, at this time we just try to make sure that that bias was reduced as much as possible by just involving the study population in the development of this process.
Okay. And then what was the construct that you eliminated?
Yeah, so the construct that was eliminated was conscious eating. And I'll go back to that slide just for a reference. So you'll see here, conscious eating was not retained in that final model of the questionnaire. And the reason why is because we had about three items in that particular factor. However, the items just dispersed to other factors and ended up loading just differently than expected. So it wasn't that it was removed. It's just that those items were related to different factors, unlike what we initially proposed.
Okay. And did you conduct any cognitive testing with low-income adults?
We did not. I think that that's definitely something worth exploring.
And then a follow-up question on if you worked with, for like older adults, how many new subjects would you need for that new population?
How many new subjects would you need? So we're at 19 items now. Again, confirmatory, I always suggest 250 responses just as a minimum for a confirmatory factor analysis. And given that we're at 19 items, I don't think you would have to have any more than that. Although as always, more is better, but you do need complete responses. You don't need responses back where they skipped some of the items. You need everyone to have answered all of the survey items.
To that point, that was another reason why in the first version where we had the does not apply option as a response option, that was one of the reasons why we removed that, because we did want to make sure that, you know, what Dr. Cater just mentioned was being addressed.
And then actually this next question is about response options. How did you select the response options? It says it seems like there could be a middle option missing sometimes.
Yeah, and so response options for me are always so fun, because typically there is a middle, and we purposely chose a 4-point liquor type scale so that there was not a middle option. It was very interesting, again, going from having that does not apply option in the first version to moving over to our second version where there was not a middle option. And so respondents were able to respond with either a never, often, always, or sometimes response scale to the different items that were asked. Would you like to add anything, Peter?
Yeah. So the next question, do you produce any scoring system to identify whether respondents do have either a good literacy or poor food literacy?
So that was actually a next step. Unfortunately, well, I mean, it was definitely a great thing that I graduated, but that was one of the things that I just wasn't able to do with timing because, you know, being that this was part of my dissertation work, I was on a timeline, but that was something that we were interested in considering and is possible next steps for this questionnaire.
Well, thank you so much. Thanks for all the great questions from our participants, and thank you to both of you for sharing your work and for giving us a really nice background on questionnaire development. So at this point, I can hand it back over to Rachel.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Just a reminder that there is a survey when I close the webinar, and appreciate your feedback on this session, as well as ideas for future sessions. And watch for an email later this week, which will be the follow-up with your recording CEU certificate and the handout. And then just a reminder, Journal Club, I don't think, meets again for I believe it's 2 weeks, but if you check on the SNEB website, you'll be able to see, yeah, Journal Club meets again on April 5th. So you'll see upcoming webinars. Actually, there's a webinar on careers in sustainable food that starts at 2 o'clock. So 15 minutes if you want to jump off and grab that other webinar. But all the SNEB webinar registrations are up on the website. So thank you all so much for joining us today. And we look forward to see you on a future session.
Thank you.
Thank you.